Welcome back. We are talking with Richard Dewhurst about his book, The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America. I wanted to carry on talking a little bit more about the Smithsonian and if there are any, if you believe that there are, I mean, obviously what would give away this a little bit, I doubt that this would happen, but it would be if an insider spoke out or not. But I'm beginning to wonder if the people today that are actually working in the Smithsonian, how aware they are of their own past and history, Richard.
I would say that based on the academic indoctrination that not only I received, but they received at higher levels than I did, there's probably no awareness of the general people that are working there of any of this. It was incredibly difficult for me to get my hands on some of these Smithsonian reports from the 19th century, and in them they clearly show that the Smithsonian themselves discovered giants. So internally, this material has been repressed completely, as far as I can tell.
And wouldn't it be a shame if some of the people working there don't even, you know about this, or even where some of the things have gone? If there's no, I guess, you know, keepers of this of this material anymore, kind of in touch with the information, it might have been lost in that regard. I don't know if that is the case, but certainly sad if.
Well, Eyjolf Kvikke, whose name I have a very hard time pronouncing. He was the head of the Smithsonian, took over in 1903, and he was the man that came up with the land bridge theory. By all the accounts I've read, just refused to examine the skeletons that were pouring into the Smithsonian. And in part, this was to keep the Powell Doctrine in place, and also to keep his own theory in place, which is the world-famous theory. You look at any map of the migration into the Americas, and it comes out of Asia, and it goes across Alaska, and it's supposedly then they walked through Canada. Except for the dates that we've now got, which go back to 10,000 B.C., you could not physically have walked through Canada, period. So his entire career would have been.
Yeah, exactly. It's. I hope that there will be some people also contacting you about this who might actually have access to finds, let's say something that their grandfather, you know, bought. If this was the case, because you mentioned that before, that it was people actually bought this kind of stuff, and it might be things that actually are tucked away in, you know, still in a cellar or an attic somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's numerous accounts of them giving away giant skulls and bones. The find I told you about in Niagara Falls, they talk about, you know, the public swarming to the area and taking out skulls, bones, etc. I've heard veiled reports that many of the Masonic lodges in America had and venerated these giant bones much in the same way that they took the skull of Geronimo in Skull and Bone Society.
Right.
And I think also because what I try to do with these articles is not just give you the little blurb of how tall the guy was. I tried to show you exactly where the location was, where the farm site was, where the mounds were located. And I think that people reading the book that live in these areas are going to have now a heightened awareness of what they're living around, and possibly will start getting new reports.
Exactly. Yeah.
Things.
Exactly. It's a very good suggestion. Now, I haven't. I've been trying to look in the reports as well as to the accuracy of the clear location of them. I mean, is there anything such as a map over America in terms of like dots on the map, like here were the finds kind of thing?
No. I mean, at one point, I started putting a Google map of my own together. It got so crowded with markers that I could hardly read it after a while. But what became really clear is that 90% of these finds, at least, indicate an advanced nautical culture. I mean, what you find are islands were used extensively for burials, for instance. But the major river systems along the Ohio River is where you're getting huge amounts of these things. The Mississippi River, Cahokia, is at the intersection of the Illinois, Missouri, and Mississippi River. And it's very interesting because it's also called Cairo,
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And not only have they found tons of giants there, but that's also where the there's been a disputed number of thousands of stelas that have come out of there that, that indicate, possible lost tribe. The guy, Frank Joseph, wrote a book on King Juba, who may have relocated there with the Ptolemaic lineage. And it's very interesting because also in Kentucky, where a lot of these, the site there is called Carthage, and you know, you begin to wonder after a while, somebody must have known something because they're naming these cities after ancient sites.
Well, exactly. I mean, Cairo is in Alexander County, you know, and mm-hmm. I think, that whole story as well comes along with it there. And there's stories that even the Roman 9th Legion left for America as well.
Yep, absolutely.
It's almost like a refuge place. I mean, I've heard stories about this too, that there were, you know, conflict on the European continent at many different times, of course, and persecutions and everything else from the, you know, Knights Templar to the Vikings to other kind of smaller Christian groups and everything else that have been in droves have left at different times from Europe and possibly actually encountered or have knowledge about the existence of America and left there to have some refuge, right?
Yes, absolutely. And talking about the copper mines, specifically, I thought one thing that was very interesting was that the copper mine activity stopped around 1500 BC, which is when the Santorini volcanic explosion happened, and that factors into Exodus, but it also factors into the Cretan boat markings that they found. So it basically stopped, and then it started up again 900 AD, and that's exactly the same time when the Vikings are reported to have shown up there.
Ah.
I don't find that coincidental.
No.
I mean, I think there was a nautical, the portolans that have turned up, Charles Hapgood wrote about quite extensively, show that there was a worldwide nautical culture that we have known, sometimes call them the seafaring people, the Scythians, the Iberians, the Celts, you know, a lot of different names for whatever this ancient worldwide civilization was. And I think some of that knowledge, you know, continued well up until, you know, through the Vikings and then by extension into the Knights Templar. And some of their disappeared fleets may possibly have come to the Americas as well, as early as, you know, 12 and 1300 AD.
Exactly. It's, it's interesting to see that the history of America might have been what it always seems to have been in that regard, or just that it's a big melting pot and a lot of different, you know, people went, you know, came over here in different, which makes the trying to pin down of origins or this question of like who it belongs to even more difficult, of course, you know.
And again, we have this sort of European myopia that we've been taught with, is that we had to have discovered America.
Well, exactly, you know, yeah.
And when I start seeing it, examples of high culture mummification and weaving at 7, 8, 9,000 BC in the Americas, I begin wondering, well, maybe, you know, it's the other way around.
Yeah, you have a little piece on that in terms of some of the red-haired corpses that was found, and that we might have been a eastward migration or from the west to towards the east of actually is there any evidence that a pre-Clovis culture have actually stemmed from America, come out from there, and then traveled over to the European continent?
Well, there's certainly no academic evidence of it, but one of the most surprising things was when I first started reading about the discoveries in Spirit and Lovelock Cave in Nevada, Arizona, California, all these things. I began, you know, I lived out in California for 25 years. A, I never heard of any of this while I was out there, and B, I knew that most of these were in desert areas, and it just didn't make any sense to me. And then, you know, so I had to do research into what the geology was at that time, and it turns out that Lake Lahontan, which was out there, was the biggest freshwater, one of the biggest freshwater lakes, and equaling the size of the Great Lakes. And that it was one of the lushest biospheres on Earth at that point, you know, very habitable for 5,000 years. Where Europe at that same time was freezing cold.
Right. So it might have been a lot of this. It might have been climactic reasons. Migration have occurred because of. I mean,
migration based on climate change.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Now let's see if we can talk a little bit about. I think you wrote about the Mandan, the Native American people, and they found also furthermore these seem to be very prominent with the red-haired giants for some reason.
Yes, there's. You know, that goes through the bog mummy finds, the sitakas out west. You keep coming up with red-haired giants all over the place. and to a lesser extent, blondes, and then black hair as well.
But, yeah.
A huge preponderance of, you know, which brings up, you know, the Scythian question and the tribe of Dan. And when you're looking at the Mandans, I think you're looking at the same culture that is the Tuatha De Danann or the people of the Danube River, this Anu Dan name comes up over and over and over again.
Right.
The Anunnaki, the sons of Anak, the Anakstazi, you know. That's the one theme I seem to pick up all over the place.
Fascinating. Did we talk about Spirit Cave yet, Nevada?
Well, Spirit Cave is the other very well documented in terms of the possessions of those giants did not go to the Smithsonian. They were kept within Nevada. And I have photographs of the skulls that were found there. Now, they're in a very small museum now in Nevada still, but they're prohibited from showing them. And this gets to the NAGPRA laws, which are also factoring into this story very significantly. And these were passed in 1990, and NAGPRA stands for the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act. And that basically says that any ancient bones found in the Americas belong to the local Indian tribes. And again and again and again, the local Indian tribes are stepping forward, not only claiming possession of these, but forbidding scientists from examining them.
Really?
There's a very famous case called the Kennewick Man, which happened up in Washington, where a couple kids were at a boat race after a big rainstorm, and they found a skeleton poking out of the side over there, and they reported it to the police. And the police came, examined it, said it wasn't a recent murder. And the scientists got involved, and they started testing these bones, and they were finding out that they were thousands of years old. They hadn't done complete testing on them yet. And in the process of that, the local Indian tribe stepped forward, claimed them, and then a legal battle went on for over 5 years in the courts, and eventually a group of major group of scientists from all the universities out in the West Coast got together, and they finally won the case, and it turns out that the Kennewick Man was 9,000 years old, and they have a test now called the Haplogroup Genome X test.
Right.
And these came up positive for that, which indicates Northern European lineage, and no relation to the local Indians. There was a huge tourist exhibit in Illinois by a man named Don Dixon discovered, I think it was 90 miles south of Peoria. He was digging on his farm up there and started uncovering skeletons. And he found an ancient burial ground of 3,000 skeletons. And he exposed 250 of them to the open air and built an exhibit around it. And for years, it was the most popular tourist attraction, one of the most popular in Illinois. And again, the local Indians stepped forward and said, those are our ancestors. You must close the thing down, and we're taking them. And they closed the whole exhibit and reopened it with no skeletons, and it went from 75,000 visitors a year to almost none.
Wow.
And this has happened multiple times throughout the country in the last 20 years. Even though the local Indian legends say that you know, there was a race prior to us that were the giants, and they were the mound builders.
Yeah. Do you think that someone have used the American Indians and kind of done this in their name, do you think, to like to continue with the cover up effectively?
I think it's one of those hand in glove situations where if you already have a paradigm in place where you want to suppress this information, that it's very convenient to use the local Indian tribes as a way to shutting it down.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to argue when somebody says these are our revered ancestors and this is a seen travesty.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, how do you argue with an emotional argument like that? Even when the science is saying these are 8,000-9,000-year-old skeletons that have genomes that don't match yours, it doesn't seem to matter. The, you know, the courts just side with the Indians because that's the official federal policy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think the Indians in general know much about ancient history in the Americas either. So.
Well, it's a shame, you know, that the investigation in that regard can't continue, no matter where it leads. You know, it's just we want to know and we want to understand what happened and the different migration waves and everything else. But it's a real shame when it's done in that name. But as far as you know, is there any indication then in some of these other sites that have been, they seem to have been kind of cleaned and have they been, I mean, have they been completely cleaned from all the finds that were there, do you think? Or do you think that some of the sites actually might still have?
I think there's mounds all over America. When I lived out in California, I didn't know any of this. I would constantly see mountain configurations, hills, mounds that didn't look natural to me. And I would think, well, gee, maybe I'm just projecting. Or you see oftentimes, you know, grandfather mountain, or this, you know, resembles a face, or this, you know. And I really think that the ancient geoforming that this culture engaged in was so extensive and in our face that we don't see what's sitting right in front of us many times. Now, these mounds, right to the time we're talking about, are still getting destroyed. I tried to include some late articles that I came across. It was too late to put in a book, but there was Walmart was involved down in Alabama, where Moundville is, and huge mounds of giants down there that have been found. Another major mound that I didn't even know existed, and Walmart was petitioning to tear it down and use it for a parking lot, and apparently it was passing this, you know, through the city council.
Oh boy!
And again, you read the article, and there's no awareness at all in the article of what they're dealing with.
Unbelievable. Well, they're destroying America in a number of ways, then, Walmart. Now,
well, and then also in the last several months in St. Louis, they've been doing road work, putting in new roads and stuff, and they've discovered that the Cahokia complex was even more extensive than the. The reports that I have in the book say that there was at least 150 mounds there, of which I think 60 were preserved. A lot of these were just bulldozed and plowed into oblivion well before, you know, hundreds of years ago.
But yeah.
I think by using some of the guides that I provide in the book in terms of location and things, if people go out into their local areas with some of that knowledge and start looking around, I think they'll find more mounds out there.
Exactly. Well, I think I'm going to look into that, see if I can find a link. I think there are some sites that also, I know there are definitely in Europe, megalithic.co.uk, that lists many of the different sites around in all of Europe where they have, you know, images and pictures of people that have gone out to the site and they can submit, you know, their reports basically. Mm-hmm. But are you familiar with
the other problem here, you know, that you just reminded me of that enters into this whole thing is that the mound builders have no official recognition as an Indian tribe or Aboriginal tribe, whatever you want to call it, with the American government. And that's because nobody's ever stepped forward and said, I am a legitimate descendant of the mound builders.
Right.
And one of the early drafts of the book, I was joking that the famous basketball player Bill Walton, who's over 7 feet and red-haired, should step forward on behalf of the mound builders and say, well,
exactly.
I'm a descendant. give me official protection.
Exactly.
They have no official protection. I mean, you can make up an Indian tribe like they did in Connecticut and open a gambling institution, but you can't step forward and say, I'm from the mound builders.
Yeah, because again, it's one of those things that haven't been recognized.
They don't recognize them.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So they have no official standing in the court.
So that is very interesting. I wonder what will happen with this particular field, and just the fact that there's so many people looking into this now. Do you think that the field overall will gain recognition as we go forward and more people begin savvy about this and maybe even using it in the legal context that you mentioned?
Yes. I think that the internet, one of the unintended things that's happened is that someone like me can sit down and compile hundreds of years now of evidence, whereas before it would have been physically impossible. And this is going to open people's eyes not only in America, but in Central America, South America, Europe, Russia. I mean, look at Göbekli Tepe, what's come out of there.
Yeah.
It's completely shattered the paradigm of the dating that they think. And once people become more comfortable with the idea that there's extensive evidence, 10 to 20,000 years of it, for advanced culture all over the world, and that in many of these myths and many of these societies, there's legends of the giants. And one of the things that I think you come away with from my book is that these legends are based on fact. And these facts not only apply to America, but they apply exactly to where you're living right now.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you guys went out and started scouring around, you'd find mounds.
Oh, we have. We've done tremendous traveling in the last 2 years back and forth, and it's just an amazing amount out there. And it's, you know, some of them are marked, sure, but it's a lot, as you said. You become kind of savvy in seeing the landscape after a while, and you can kind of see that doesn't look normal. There's something going on there, and there's a number of other factors in the landscape that suggests to you, you can almost sense it in a way, actually.
Yeah.
That it's something there.
Well, yeah, the Bosnian finds, and then recently in Ecuador on the equator, which is where the Ica stones came out of, there's I've seen on YouTube video of the thing. It's called the Ligantes Pyramid, and translated, that means the Pyramid of the Giants.
Yeah.
And they're right now in the deep jungle in there, stripping away and exposing this thing. And again, it completely conforms to every legend in the area.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned dinosaurs, and there's a couple of interesting factors with there playing into the dragons and stuff, but there's other interesting animals coming through in this as well. You talk about the Thunderbirds a little bit as well, reports on those.
Thunderbirds, giant sloths, and mastodons and elephants. And the mastodon and elephant finds are very persuasive. The pipes that they found that are completely anatomically correct of mastodons. There was also effigy mounds in the shapes of, this is up in Iowa where they found them, of mastodons and elephants, giant sloths, huge birds, which brings up, you know, as you said, the Thunderbird legends. And a lot of the American Indian iconography that I thought was restricted to just you know, like an Apache tribe or something. It turns out a lot of this goes way back into the mound culture, including the Thunderbird imagery. So,
yeah.
Again, it's a lot more ancient, you know. And these things weren't, you know, invented by Plains Indians living in teepees. You know, these legends predate them by thousands of years.
What do you think makes that rise and fall in ability to do some of these extraordinary works? You know, in terms of architecture or how you shape the landscape and everything, and then for a while it seems to just kind of disappear, and humanity overall loses the ability to do these things, and we're like, as you said...
Well, I've thought quite a bit about that, you know, and I don't really talk about it in the book, but, you know, the one really amazingly glaring thing is that we're not dealing with a mercantile economy here, okay?
Yeah.
We're dealing with a coordinated social structure that celebrated making the earth a sacred landscape. And this was a legitimate job, you know. Even in Smithsonian reports, they estimate that millions of people must have been engaged in this work. So you have a completely different social structure, a completely different outlook on life. and a legitimate occupation for people to engage in. And I think that's true all over the world, that before money became the money and time, you know, once we switched over to money and clocks, all of a sudden you find that all of the sacred architecture, landscape work disappears out of the landscape. I read somewhere the most important building in any city is the tallest one. Well, in the old days, those would have been churches and sacred spaces, and now they're bank buildings. Right? With big clocks on top of them.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The Commerce Building and everything else. Now, it's... I was looking a little bit more at Poverty Point. You have some reports on that as well. That has to be one of the largest sites, I think, overall in terms of earthworks.
And it's just recently been recognized as a heritage site. Now, Poverty Point is on the Mississippi River down the northern Louisiana border, and it's a huge circular earth mound construction. And they found very many anomalous objects in there that they thought they started saying, well, we think they're like cooking stones, but then they also found things that looked like things to use to make shaped objects. And when I started getting deeply into the copper culture of Michigan, and I started reading, you know, some of the more alternative theories that are coming out, they're beginning to develop a pretty convincing argument that a lot of this copper was taken out of Michigan during the summer and brought down to Poverty Point and then manufactured into trading hides of copper and then shipped down to the Gulf of Mexico for international distribution. Huh. This site could have been as many as 100,000 people. And then there's a site, the Cato culture, which is on the Arkansas-Oklahoma border. And again, this involves the manufacture of a dam. And I can't tell you how many times in my research that dams were built over these ancient sites and obliterated them. The reports that came out of there was that there was a town of 100,000 people in Oklahoma. Then the earlier reports out of the cliff-dwelling area out west says that two of those areas had populations of 100,000 people. And the estimates of the city up by Niagara Falls could have been up to 100,000 people. The Cahokia complex, which I said was 50 and 60,000, they've now found it's much larger, and they're saying that that's probably 100,000 people.
Wow.
So, again, we have completely distorted picture of what this country was like.
That's right. And the rivers, they were the highways, and that's how you transported most of your thing, it seems like. All, I mean, that's true in Northern Europe as well, that there's striking similarities according to where you can see some of the sites, you know, weaving around these snake-like, you know, rivers that circles around in the landscape. You know, it's very much tied to that, you know.
Well, now, I actually, when I was taking Google Maps and I was trying to create my own web map, which you asked me about earlier, I started to, you know, with the major river systems, because a lot of huge earthworks and so on and so forth and giant finds are found in proximity to the major river systems. But then the tributary systems, I started, well, okay, here's a find, and it's on this one. And I literally, you could... you know, go in at Savannah, Georgia, for instance, and go all the way up to Lake Erie on these systems.
Yeah.
And along them, if you look at Google Map, and it's probably the same in Europe, you're going to find that a lot of these ponds and waterways look very artificial. And I'm beginning to suspect that not only did they create effigy mounds, but they also were working with... water sculpture.
Oh yeah, creating exactly. You're right. I'm trying to find out. There's a website I lost actually a couple of years ago now. That showed the different earthworks tied to the river system. But there's more than that. It was basically petroglyphs found in the kind of the low country landscape around in eastern United States as well. I've been struggling to find it since then, but that showed some potential amazing landscaping, if you will, of this type of environment, you know? So
yeah, and there's one fellow, I can't remember his name, but he's started using Google Earth and Google Maps like I was, and he's now compiling areas. There's areas of the Mississippi where there's long, straight canals. There's canals on the East Coast, all the way up to New Hampshire. And these odd-looking ponds, if you ever get onto Google Earth and you get down to a certain level, there's a pond in Savannah or Charleston, I can't remember which, that's called Alligator Pond, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you look at it, and it's an alligator. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks just like an effigy, man, except it's made out of water. And you see this, you know, the like Raven Pond, and you look at it, and it's actually, it doesn't just look like a raven, you know? And a lot of these things haven't eroded, and somebody did some studying, and they seem to indicate the extensive use of Portland cement all over the United States. The Smithsonian reports something. Out in the cliff dwellers say that millions of pounds of Portland cement were used, and they can't figure out where it came from. Many of the mounds inside they're reinforced with Portland cement. A lot of these ancient cities that were discovered, there was evidence of cement all over the place.
And what makes Portland cement? Is it different in some way?
It's just a certain consistency that they can type and classify. I'm not really, but the stuff out in the cliff dwellers and architectural, you can tell looking at that, it doesn't look like anything else that relates to the American Indians. And again, in the Smithsonian reports, when they asked the Indians out there, they said, we didn't build any of this.
Yeah. No, it's, I think the level of, what might have gone on in terms of the high culture, if you will, has been very much forgotten, and I don't think we have a concept, a really good idea of what actually was going on at the time, you know. And we're constantly struggling with this idea that there somehow is more they weren't as advanced, etc. I mean, certainly some of the metal things that has been found that are way, you know, out of place in terms of the historical record seem to indicate that there was. You know, civilization has come and gone. It's risen and fallen many different times on this planet.
And another of the scientific paradigms that I mentioned about the Smithsonian is that everything was based on the theory of gradualism, which, you know, that Earth went on for a long time and didn't really change, and that people and animals got bigger and smarter and all of this kind of stuff. And it created a myth in our minds, you know, that refused to open our eyes to the fact that cultures rise and fall, you know,
yeah,
for a variety of reasons, including catastrophes. I mean, they still won't recognize the advanced engineering in the Great Pyramids or how they moved 1,200-ton stones into the Trilithon at Baalbek. They just won't talk about it.
No. I know, it's an elephant in the room right there. There are also, you mentioned it briefly before that, but pyramids and other kind of pictorial mounds in America, and on comparison, how are they with some of the other pyramids around?
Well, the biggest structures seem to be earthworks, but I ran across two or three descriptions of pyramid with stone courses at the bottom, and again, they were destroyed. And then there's anomalous stories. For instance, there's one out of Wisconsin that keeps turning up of these pyramids that are supposedly at the bottom of a lake there. And I had read about that prior to cracking open this giant story. But again, when I started matching the giant finds in that particular lake, they seem to overlap. And, you know, at some point, you know, in extreme ancient history, I think there was a worldwide culture that was technically advanced, that had mapped the oceans and rivers of the world, and by some accounts, had mapped Antarctica as well. And a seafaring worldwide civilization existed in some isolated areas of knowledge longer than in others.
Yeah.
And but in our general reconstruction of history, we just think, you know, the farther back you go, the more primitive things are. And I would say the evidence shows the exact opposite. You know?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Now, do you think that there could be any way that we could, because it seems to be out of the question of digging into some of these mounds, unfortunately, at least at this time. But technology, I mean, there are certain deep penetrating radar, you can look into it, etc. But is there any active work being done on this, as far as you know of, actually trying to figure out what's down there? Is it metal? Is there cavities? You know?
No, because the federal laws are so strict, and as I said, NAGPRA is the big one, but you cannot get permission to dig in any of these things, and the universities are not cooperating and using their muscle to break this thing open. And I know a friend of mine had lived out in California on a big ranch that had been identified as an archaeological site, and inspectors would come out there just to make sure that nobody had dug anywhere. So it becomes very difficult for the layman, unless he just, it's on his own property, perhaps, you know, that he has you seem to have a legal right to plow it to pieces, but you don't have a legal right to dig it out and examine it.
That's great.
I mean, that's where we're at. Destroy it. Oh, that's fine.
Right.
Walmart, make it into a parking lot. Go right ahead.
That's amazing. Oh, boy. Now, let's see if we can talk about some of the other reports here. There are a couple other sites that are fascinating as I'm just looking through here. Monk's Mound, you know, seems to be a pretty big one as well. Woodhenge,
yeah.
You know, there's tons. What are some of your other favorite places and reports that we haven't talked about so far?
Well, I don't know. We didn't really mention the West Virginia mounds too much, but they're spectacularly large. They're some of the biggest outside of Cahokia. And again, the thing that distinguishes them is they were examined twice in the 19th century by the Smithsonian. Both times they found giants there. And then, in Pennsylvania, they in the area of Sayre, they found not only 65 giant skeletons, some of which were shipped to the Carnegie Institution, but they also found a horned giant. And there's a photograph of it in the book. The fellow that was leading that particular dig was from Andover's Exeter Prep School, and he turns out to be the same guy that was involved in the last dig that happened in Cahokia. The horned giant disappeared, and out in Cahokia, they refused to say how big any of the skeletons were they found. So I think he was, you know, one of the point men involved in keeping a lid on some of this stuff. You might say to yourself, well, horned giants, you know, but as it turns out, there's statues of Alexander the Great and Moses. There's one in the Vatican that I reproduce. Where they both have horns.
Oh yeah, the Moses statue. That's a very, very, very known one. So, what was found out about this particular one with that you replicate? I'm looking at it right now in the book there. What that actually was, the horns.
Some people said, you know, it's an alien, and other people, you know, said it somehow ties into the legends of, you know, horned leaders, giants, you know, the mythology. Again, we can't say for sure because it just disappears. You know, even though there's a picture of it, it's just gone. Ohio is just, the finds in Ohio are just astonishing.
Yeah, yeah.
8, 9, 10, 11-foot giants everywhere. amount of pearls found in the burials are unbelievable. In one burial site, they found 500,000 freshwater pearls.
Wow.
Often the giant mounds were stuffed with them. There's accounts of them laying on a tapestry of pearls made into a huge bird, robes made out of pearls. There's not only in Ohio and the Newark area, but further over, multiple cases into Indiana of 8-10 skeletons found clad in copper armor with copper headdresses. Detailed accounts of swords and hatchets and spear points and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And details that you wouldn't believe.
It's extraordinary, and I'm just so saddened by the way it has stagnated this kind of work. And so what needs to give here for anything to kind of move along in this field? Because again, I mean, as we've talked about this before with other guests on the program as well, it seems like the best reports are like late 1800s, early 1900s kind of thing, and then it just
it drops off
exactly. It's just like what needs to happen there? What needs to budge for this to?
Well, I think there has to be a general awareness of first of all, even if you don't want to accept the fact that giants are found in a huge amount of these mounds, that there was a mound builder culture and that we recognize it as such, and give it official standing. And until the mound builders are officially recognized by the federal government as a legitimate, whether you want to call them Indians or ancient Americans or whatever you want to call it, they have to be recognized, number one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then locally, people have to take some of this into their own hands and start exploring where they know that many mounds have already been found, and start going out and taking pictures and taking videos and posting stuff on the internet. And eventually, it's going to become accepted. And that's the biggest hurdle, not only in America, but across the world, that people have to accept that there is some form of high culture, you know, that revolves around certain characteristics. It was a river culture. If you're seeing mounds in your area, if you're seeing rock work, petroglyphs, things like that, all these are indications that there's an ancient, what they call Paleo-Indian presence in your area. And hopefully some people will start coming forward, not only individually in families where they may have some of this stuff. Masonic lodges, a lot of them have closed down over the years. Maybe some of the materials will come out of there, but eventually people within the Smithsonian themselves have to start stepping forward. And I think, you know, the thing I told you at the earlier in the broadcast, the article I saw yesterday about Santa Rosa Island and the Smithsonian out there, coming forward and saying, yes, there's human presence here at 10,000 BC, and yes, they had boats.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of the opening that's going to be necessary.
Exactly, exactly. And there's, you know, tons more finds that you detail in the book about, you know, different treasures and different stones and, you know, all kinds of remarkable things there. And
writing, hieroglyphs,
yeah.
Egyptian writing, Punic writing, coins from Rome, coins from Israel, holy stones, and recognized by local universities and kept in collections. And many times these things were attacked by the Smithsonian and called hoaxes.
Yeah.
And then over the last 100 years, they've been reexamined and authenticated.
Yeah.
I mean, Barry Fell wrote a series of books in the '70s, America BC and a couple of others, which were some of the first I ever read to open my mind to some of this material. And it's very interesting that a lot of that's stuff he was talking about, like the Davenport Stella, which came out of Iowa, when I started doing my giant research, well, lo and behold, you know, not only are there amazing giant finds in the exact same area, but huge earthworks and mounds all over. And once people become familiar with the fact that these waterways were extensively used over thousands of years, I think they're going to begin recognizing things that they didn't see before.
Very good. Very, very good. Yeah, it's extremely fascinating. The work on this will, of course, carry on, and you've done a great, you know, composition, again, as I've mentioned a couple of times now, but, you know, of all the articles and all the finds, and you know, this is for something that people can look into for themselves. They could, this could develop into something that you began a little bit there with, some kind of map and mapping, so people can go out and find locations and see this for themselves. And it's just, it can go in a number of ways from here, but I think it's interesting what you mentioned, that it could literally turn into some kind of, you know, the recognition and rights of the mound builders, if you will. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Henrik, I really appreciate your kind words about the book. Yes, and with help with people like you who are out there, you know, with a public forum, you know, I think eventually we can push over the old scientific paradigm and begin to open up people's minds to the real true history of the world.
Absolutely. That's it's our duty to keep pushing ahead on those things for everyone who wants to know the real story, the real history and everything else. So good job on the book, Richard. And are you looking ahead for something else right now, or what's next for you?
Well, I've been compiling. Well, the original book was twice as long as the one that eventually got published. So there's a huge amount of material I'm still sitting on. But, you know, I'm beginning to try and put a hard news primary source picture of the worldwide culture that involves giants and mound builders and extremely ancient civilizations. So I'm looking for the through line to it, but I'm sitting on a ton of information.
Right. Well, there's more to do there then. That's awesome. Well, in the meantime, we say thank you, Richard, for your work. And I want to repeat again here that the book is called The Ancient Giants Ruled America, The Missing Skeletons and the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. And we will have it linked up on our websites to Amazon and everything else. And yeah, keep up the good work, Richard. And again, thank you for your time. I hope we can talk more again in the future.
Real pleasure. Thank you so much, sir.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you go. That's our program for today. We say thanks for listening and for being a member. Upcoming, we have Ben Davidson, William Line, also William Mullen, Robert Felix, and Sophia Smallstorm. Stay tuned for much more radio on exciting and essential topics. The websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Then we also have Radio 314 this Wednesday on the over-medication of America, and also those who implemented the pharmacological system, radio314.com, or find the links from the Red Ice Radio Archive. Have a great rest of your day or evening, and we'll talk to you in just a couple of days.